You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Schizophrenia is a condition that often involves delusions and paranoia. It affects roughly 1% of the population.
And while the symptoms of the condition haven't changed, the nature of it has changed with the times.
Andrew Morantz joins us to explain what's going on. He's an editor and writer at The New Yorker. He has a recent piece called Unreality Star. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So to set the stage, describe what schizophrenia is and paranoid schizophrenia as you wrote about it. What are some of the basic symptoms?
Well, there are a whole range of schizoid disorders, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, that, you know, involve hallucinations, delusions, detachment from reality. You know, we've given different names to this kind of cluster of symptoms over time, but there have always been people, for reasons that are largely unknown, who perceive kind of an entire coherent reality that's separate from the reality that many other people perceive.
And the thing you write about is that the way that reality manifests itself has changed over time. It's not the same for everybody. It's not the same now as it was, say, a couple decades ago.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, our beliefs are always changing because of the input that we're getting from our society. You know, that includes rational and irrational beliefs. That includes, you know, every belief that we have, and this includes delusional beliefs, which are beliefs that people hold contrary to evidence. So, yeah, the things that are that you perceive and see in the world around you enter your psyche and come out in all kinds of unpredictable ways.
And it's fascinating to me because I think of something like schizophrenia as, I guess, maybe hardwired, and it affects your brain in a certain way. But it's really an interaction between the condition and the culture around us.
That's absolutely true. There are many ways in which it's an interaction, some of which are so deep, you know, epigenetics and in utero environment that I didn't even get into them in the piece. But one very easy way that we can conceive of the interaction is just in terms of form versus content. So there are certain forms that mental illness has always taken in society, but the content of those delusions is always going to change. It's kind of a old wine and new bottles kind of situation.
So what has been the change in the last few decades? What did people a generation or two ago believe was happening to them versus what they believe now often?
There were people during the Cold War who thought that Soviet satellites were controlling their thoughts through radio waves. There were people, I mean, this basically happens every time there's a major technological shift in society. You know, when the telegraph was invented, there were people who thought that their thoughts were being broadcast through that. The telephone, same thing. It's kind of a natural response. If you're a person who's prone to seeing threats everywhere, that all of a sudden there's a powerful new instrument that has never existed before, you know, your brain might leap to, what if this is used to do me harm? Of course, now we have things like the NSA tapping our phones. We have drones everywhere. We have space satellites in wide use. These things are all really happening. And so it's just a slight imaginative leap to think about how they could be used to harm an individual.
Well, and a natural fit, and this is what you write about most, is reality TV.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, in the human psyche, it's always been tempting to imagine oneself as a celebrity. And nowadays, anyone can be a celebrity. I mean, with, you know, ever since The Real World, and arguably, you know, it's taken off hugely since then, you know, you can be, it's kind of like, well, there's no reason Snooki should be a big celebrity and I shouldn't, you know. So there are certain people whose brains tell them, well, you are, you know, you already are, and the cameras are being kept secret from you, but they're there, and that explains why things kind of feel so weird in your life.
Now, you focus on one person who has been through this, and you met him, actually, toward the end of your research, it sounds like. Can you tell his story and how this reality TV concept played out in his life?
Sure. Well, Nick Lotz was going through college, kind of, you know, smart, normal kid who sort of more and more got the impression that people were kind of talking about him behind his back and maybe looking at him funny, which is an impression that people sometimes have, but the paranoia sort of started sliding more and more out of control. And in a way, his brain kind of put together an explanation of why are people looking at me funny? You know, why do people sort of seem to stop when I walk in the room? And the thing that he hit on was, oh, I must be famous and they must be broadcasting a 24-hour reality show about me and people must be looking at me because of that. And then from there, his brain was able to spin out a fabulous confabulation that took over his life for about 2.5 years, where he felt 24 hours a day that he was being broadcast and that he was a national celebrity. And it included everything from, you know, the internet he was looking at was a fake version of the internet that that had been scrubbed of fan websites about him. You know, people were plants that were put there by the producers of the show. So it really consumed his life. And if you think about it, it really could have been true. I mean, there are more boring reality shows than that.
Mm-hmm. And eventually he started playing to the cameras.
Yeah, he wanted to be a good participant. I mean, there was prize money involved, so he wanted to succeed. He didn't want to get recast. So he tried to play into it. He took acting classes so he could make his performance better. He thought pretty deeply about plot structure and how to move the plot forward. And, you know, in the kind of Shakespearean all the world's a stage kind of way, it's kind of just a slightly more self-conscious version of what we all do, right? Try to move the plot forward every day in our lives. He was just doing it for his audience.
And we hear often in some cases of mental illness, the cliche, he heard voices. The voices he heard were producers of the show. Is that right?
Yeah, that's not a cliche. That's a common symptom. And a big feature of this is that you have the symptom and then you retroactively try to justify what it means, kind of like in a dream. And so he would hear voices telling him to do things or go certain places, and he would say, oh, that must be the producers of my show, and they're giving me instructions over this little wireless microphone, which, again, you know, kind of a more parsimonious explanation for it than some other people have invented.
So when people in his family, his friends, confronted him with the thought that he might have a mental illness, he accused them of going off script. How did people convince him to seek treatment, which you found out he did?
It's hard. It's hard to convince someone of something like that, especially because he didn't want to break the fourth wall. You know, if you're in a successful reality show, the first thing they're going to edit out is anyone talking too explicitly about the making of the reality show. So you don't want to look directly at the camera. You don't want to say, boy, I'm tired of being under these lights. You know, you want to play it cool. So he didn't really want to talk about it with anyone, and it took a lot of gentle coaxing and prodding and, frankly, just pure luck for his parents to be able to sort of gently say, hey, do you want to see a doctor? And he kept saying, no, 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 no. And eventually, you know, there were successful interventions. But yeah, it was dicey there for a while.
You met him, I think it was in December. How did he talk about, looking back, his life as a reality TV star?
He's a very funny, self-aware, smart guy. He's had a pretty heroic struggle with his delusions, and he's kind of wrestled them to the ground now. But he's pretty funny about the whole thing. I mean, he would, you know, we would drive by a field, and he would say, "Oh, that's where the producers made me, you know, put my underwear on my head and run around in circles because they wanted, you know, they wanted an episode about that." Or he would say, "You know, this is Court Street. So this was the street where everyone was a judge and I was a jury," or, you know, he remembers things with pretty vivid detail. And he, you know, it's this terrifying thing that he doesn't make light of. But then again, it's, you know, he recognizes that it's a notable and sort of, you know, interesting and quirky thing that happened to him. So he's willing to share immense detail about it.
You write that psychiatry as a profession is now less interested in the form that schizophrenia takes when it exhibits itself and looks more at the root causes. Is anyone still studying how this manifestation changes over time?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's coming more into vogue that people are studying all sides of this. And there's so much yet to be studied that we don't understand physically what's going on or sociologically what's going on. But yeah, I think that there was a pendulum shift pretty far toward the pure biology orientation. And now people are coming to recognize that, we do need to study the patterns of delusional content if we want to more fully understand the illness and our society itself.
I don't know if you went back this far, but are people thinking if you go back far enough, the explanation instead of the CIA or reality TV might have been witchcraft?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's not only a past thing. I mean, there are entire cultures where people don't talk in terms of medicalized mental illness. They talk in terms of prophets and witches and demons and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, that goes on even now.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
This is Andrew Marantz. He's a writer and editor for The New Yorker.
Coming up, NPR Science Friday's Ira Flatow tells us how to make science sexy. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.